BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Dialect Radio is back on the air for the autumn. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Josie Hill is with us in the studio today to talk about a charity that supports women on the streets, the 125 organisation. That will be followed with a report from the Edinburgh Fringe about a play written around the subject of sex trafficking called A Thousand Pieces. Matthew Heaps here with more of Matt's Muses. There's an interview with Jonathan Porritt, who was in Bristol at the Schumacher Conference. A feature by Webster Tarkley, courtesy of Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Grieve, the actor, continues with another chapter of Cider with Rosie. Jeff Sparks is away this week, but he is back on the 22nd with the What's On Guys. And I'm John Peters Conlon. Extending drinking hours is turning many market towns and city centres in the South West into Wild West zones, according to the police authority. Changes to the licensing laws, aimed at creating a cafe culture as seen on the continent, have led to booze-fuelled violence carrying on into the early hours of the morning and stretching police resources to the limit. Councillors said that antisocial behaviour was driving some residents out of the city centres. Last week, Simon Reid, Vice Chairman of the Police Federation, told MPs on the Commons, Culture, Media and Sports Committee that market towns have suffered most since the introduction of the Licensing Act. He said police were having to deal with two or three closing times rather than one. Some premises shut at 11pm or 11.30, some at 2, and others stay open until 5 in the morning. Ian Anderson, Chairman of the Gloucestershire Constabulary Federation, said that the demand for extra officers took staff away from staff response policing. In rural areas sometimes, officers had to work on their own, often having to deal with drunken gangs. Towns were becoming too dangerous for the public to walk in at night. Some councillors pointed the blame at licensed premises promoting cheap drinks and supermarkets who sold cheap alcohol. The Western Daily Press, in their comment feature, said that unlike Europeans, who are able to drink without fear of being threatened by a gang of lagerlouts, in Britain, drunkenness was something to which many people, young people especially, aspire to, and extended laws are used by them as an excuse to drink harder and longer. If residents and the police no longer feel safe in the streets of their own town, then something has to be done. Bar staff have a responsibility not to serve another pint to someone who looks as if they are over the limit, despite the consequences on their profit margins. Round-the-clock drinking is driving people to despair, so everyone needs to play their part in calling time on this unacceptable behaviour.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Josie Hill is with us here in the studio now to talk about the organisation, the 125 Project. Hi, Josie.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit about what the 125 Project is.
125 is a local Bristol charity which supports vulnerable women who are trapped in a lifestyle of street prostitution, addiction and homelessness.
Okay, why are you called 125?
Well, when we started up just over 13 years ago, we were based in a small basement at 125 Cheltenham Road. But we managed to move to a more central position in St Paul's. And when we became a charity, we asked the women, what should we call ourselves? And they said 125, that's what we know you as.
Okay, right. I mean, when I think about prostitution, I kind of think about Portland Square, Brunswick Square, Stapleton Road. Are those your sort of main sort of areas? I mean, are we talking everywhere in Bristol?
No, it's... street prostitution is based in quite a small area of inner city Bristol. I wouldn't want to list exactly where they hang out, so, you know, I don't want to annoy the residents who live there, but it's within about a mile and a half area in the inner city of Bristol.
Yeah. I mean, I live in sort of St. Paul's myself, so I kind of wear, you know, I wind up seeing a lot of them around where I live anyway, really. Have done for a couple of years. And you do wonder about them, I suppose. I mean, how they get there in the first place. I mean, what does your sort of research find about how people get, how do they kind of wind up being turning from normal people into sort of, so to speak, to prostitutes?
We've, a lot of the women tell us our stories, tell us how they got to where they are. Many of them, the vast majority of them, were actually abused as children, sexually or physically. And many of them were, this was recognised by social services some of the time, and they were taken into care. A lot of them were taken away from their mother or father they lived with. And they grew up with a lot of nightmares, a lot of things to cover up. So early on, started taking drugs, went to harder drugs, but alcohol as well. And many were dropping out of school and living this chaotic, very sad, early teenage years. And people, you know, men, drug dealers and pimps would prey on them, prey on these young girls, and get them into prostitution. And it's a very sad story.
How many, roughly, are we talking about? Do you know?
In a single month, we can see as many as 150 different women in our services. But there are believed to be even more than that on the streets.
Right, okay. So do you have a lot of sort of regulars, or do you manage to sort of help these people into sort of different ways of life so that you can kind of don't see them again for good reasons, so to speak?
There are a lot of women that we see on a regular basis, but there are always, especially when on our outreach, which we do in a van and also on foot, we do often see some new women that we've never seen before. It's very much getting out of the situation where you're addicted to heroin and often crack as well, and alcohol. You're living on the streets. There's a tremendous lot of violence. Perhaps you're being coerced by a pimp or a partner who's also a drug addict. It's incredibly hard to get out, so helping them is, we see that as often quite a long process rather than something they can get out of immediately.
So this link to the pimps, it starts as early as, very early as childhood?
It can be. I met a woman last week who actually was being pimped out by her own dad, who was a drug addict, and she had been doing so since her early teens. He'd been forcing her out onto the streets. But sometimes it's pimps. A lot of the times it's moved away from pimps and to a more shady area where they're with partners who offer them some sort of protection from violence on the streets, but at the same time force the women out so they can feed their own addiction as well as the women's addiction. And they are very confused as to how to leave this partner because they think they're loved by them.
I mean, so the people, pimps, for example, are the primary source of what gets them into sort of heavy drugs in the first place? Or is it heavy drugs and is it... And then do they kind of turn to prostitution? What is it that is it, or is it either or?
It can be any number of things. It can be a sliding scale, as I said, of a tremendously difficult and sad childhood, which they start with perhaps softer drugs or drinking, and then they're addicted to the feeling of escaping all this pain, so they will turn onto harder and harder drugs that will help erase the pain. So sometimes that can be their own choice, as it were, but the reason why they do that is something that's been inflicted upon them.
I mean, I guess there are charities that try to reach out to children at that young age, and there seem to be lots of different aspects of prostitution. So what does your 125 Project Centre do? How does it? It's helping people who are already regular prostitutes. It's like a drop-in centre that they can come to advice?
Yeah, we have several services. We have, as I mentioned before, we have the outreach that goes out and meets, goes around the main beat area, and the women come on the van and we give them food, condoms, first aid, if necessary, rush them to hospital or to emergency accommodation, lots of different things. And we encourage them to come to our drop-in centre and get more in-depth help. The drop-in centre, there's a hot meal, there's laundry, there's always caseworkers, and there's a lot of visitors come in, people from health services and drug relapse specialists from the Bristol Drugs Project, and lots of different people are there to help. And then the caseworkers are there to ask them, what do you want, how do you want to progress into exiting this lifestyle, and they help them with whatever aspect they need to do that.
Do you ever find a problem with them sort of wanting to come forward? Do they feel sort of quite ashamed, or are they usually quite ready and willing to come forward? Or, well, I guess there's a whole range of people, I guess. I mean, do you do lots of work to try and get out on the streets to encourage them in, or do you just kind of...
We're out 5 nights a week on the van and twice a week on foot. And it can be... Sometimes we meet women and they say, I am in absolute hell, I want help immediately.
Okay.
I want to come into the drop-in tomorrow and please give me a casework and help me escape.
Right.
Sometimes the women, as you can imagine, are so ashamed that they all suffer from tremendously low self-esteem. They think, you know, they've been treated like dirt. I mean, there's a lot of violence and a lot of from dangerous punters, but there's also a lot of abuse from the general public, and they have really bad self-esteem. And they have said to us, sometimes women who've exited and leading a great lifestyle afterwards have said to us, it took me time to realise why you'd want to help someone like me, and I was ashamed in coming forward, and I was scared I was going to cry if I let go of hardening up. So
yeah.
it can take a while, but when you see them afterwards and they've got their own house and they're, you know, going back into education or even starting to work, and they're really happy, it's really well worth it.
I understand you've got a new project on the go, Naomi House. Tell me a little bit about that.
We realised there was a huge gap in the market for something like this. This is a residential, highly supported mother and baby home, which is starting up in January the 5th for our women and their babies. At the moment in Bristol, if you're an addict or you're sex working and you're pregnant, there are certain places where you can stay and get housed temporarily, but there's nowhere for women once they've given birth. They're back out onto the streets. When they come out of hospital, they've just given birth. Often there's nowhere for them to stay, and so the baby gets removed. And it's tremendously difficult. It's so difficult for them to try and, you know, within a few days where their baby's in hospital, to suddenly get a house and get it furnished and become a good enough mother for approval. So it's really difficult. So we've just set up this project. It's been running for 2 years, and they'll be living there for up to 2 years, pregnant women or mothers with newborn babies. And there'll be caseworkers on hand to help them, give them parenting skills, basic skills, just learning how to cook and care for their babies, and also a lot of therapy as well to help them look at why they've become addicts and why they've led their lifestyle.
So at the moment, I mean, there are, I don't know if this sounds like a silly question, but there are women who are basically pregnant, say 8 months gone, and they're still out in the streets.
Yes. I've seen women who are about 1 week from giving birth on the streets. I've seen women who have given birth 2 days ago on the streets.
So there's definitely an overwhelming need. I mean, it surprises me that somebody isn't already offering this service in Bristol already. I suppose you were surprised yourselves, I guess.
In England and Wales, there are only 3 residential mother and baby homes for addicts, and none specifically for sex workers. We're the first one in the UK.
Right. It does make you think. I've often heard people say, I mean, society is only as strong as its weakest link, and it doesn't really say a lot for British society, if that is the case, does it?
It's no comment on that one. It's something that's been suggested. It came out in a Home Office report about 4 years ago that one thing that would really help sex workers get exit would be if there was supported accommodation for them, but.
Yeah.
That was the recommendation, and it wasn't followed up by the government themselves, so we had to take the initiative and you know, after asking our women as well, and they said that's what exactly what they'd like. That's just why we went ahead with the project.
It's just so shocking that it's the first one of its sort in the UK. I mean, it just makes you... So, I mean, the aim of that is to obviously break the cycle so that the children themselves that they bring up don't obviously...
Give them a better chance in life. And, it's research shows that children that stay with their natural mother have a much better chance in life, especially if the mother's been taught fantastic parenting skills and learning to deal with her own issues and do everything she can to be a fantastic mother to the children, then it gives them a fantastic start in life and also helps the mother when she's ready to move back into the community to input into her environment.
So tell me a little bit about the drug side of prostitution. I mean, what sort of drugs are we talking about?
Heroin and crack, with a bit of alcohol thrown in. Those are the two main controlling drugs of sex workers, heroin and crack cocaine, often taken together, sometimes separately. Looking at our service users, we did, somebody from the NHS did a survey of 125's women and found that just over 99% were addicted to heroin or crack or alcohol or all three. And it's really what drives them to the streets. There's very much a cycle of work to get money, score drugs, take drugs, work to get money, score drugs, take drugs. And they can go in this circle, sometimes for days on end. Sometimes we've seen them, they haven't slept in a few days. They're completely controlled by this drug.
Are they all sorts of new drugs coming out all the time? I mean, are there different variations in this? Do they mix these drugs? Are they sort of potentially fatally dangerous, some of the drugs that they're taking? Or?
Absolutely. You know, at the moment, there's been a lot of warnings around heroin that's been mixed with Rohypnol, which is a date rape drug, and completely knock somebody out and make them forget what's happened for hours and hours on end. It's a very, very dangerous thing. Several months ago, there was heroin that was mixed, so it was much, much stronger, and there were actually fatal cases of women taking that, overdosing and dying. It was very sad. It happens a lot that we get some horrible drugs in the market and they have tragic effects.
What can people do if they want to be able to help out the 125 organisation? Are you looking for volunteers?
Yes, we welcome volunteers. We have several volunteer introduction evenings a year. More can be found on our website. And volunteers help on outreach, they help in the drop-in centre, even on casework. Sometimes they help out with events. We have several events a year. Sometimes we have a night walk every spring, which is very funny. Everyone dresses up in fancy dress, and last year we had over 100 people storming around Bristol.
No way.
It was the first one of its kind in Bristol, actually. And it was a lot of fun. 10 miles. But sometimes we have fashion shows, auctions. We always have a team in the half marathon. And so we have people helping out with that as well. Naomi House is going to need volunteers to help come in, look after the babies, show the women basic skills like how to cook a spaghetti bolognese or, you know, go to the park and how to play with their children, things like that. But always... obviously financial help is welcomed, secondhand clothes for our drop-in, toiletries for the women, lots of different things.
So both baby clothes and sort of clothes for the prostitutes themselves, I guess, if they're spending all the money on drugs then.
Absolutely, and if you're living on the streets, you know, you don't have a wardrobe, do you? So often it's just can be what they're standing up in.
Yeah, well, I guess sort of look around your house, if you're in your house, and just... remind yourself they don't have any of that, and they probably don't know about any of it either, particularly if they've been doing it since a young sort of very, very early age. How young are the younger ranges of women that are turning into prostitution that you see?
We generally see our age range tends to be 17 to I think 53 is the oldest woman we see. If we see women under the age of 18, we have to alert Barnardo's, and that has happened. I think the youngest woman I've ever seen on the streets was 13 years old, but they tend to be, because they're underage, the pimps tend to keep them indoors to keep them away from the police. So we don't see so many as we used to now.
Right. The website, just to get in touch and find out more information, is www. And I'll spell it out longhand. You'll make sense if you write it down. www.one25.org.uk. So that's O-N-E, that's the word one, followed by the numbers 25. one25.org.uk. And that's for more information about the 125 project. Well, thank you very much for coming in today, Josie.
Thanks.
And that was a fascinating and somewhat sort of shocking insight into something that I do walk past a lot. And when I'm walking on my way home from work, you know, after I've been doing a bit of overtime, and I just sort of completely ignore them. So thank you very much for coming in today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
As a point of interest, in addendum to that, the drop-in centre itself is 138A Grosvenor Road, which is right next to Dad's Cabs.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Our first feature is from the Edinburgh Festival about a play which deals with the subject of sex trafficking, particularly the plight of women from Eastern Europe, called A Thousand Pieces.
Hello, Gemma.
Hello.
Can you tell us a bit about your production, please?
Yes, we're here performing in A Thousand Pieces. We're an all-female company called the Paper Birds, and the show looks at sex trafficking in the United Kingdom at the moment and follows the story of an Eastern European girl and her journey to England under false pretences.
What led you to think of this as an idea for a theatre show? It's very unusual, isn't it,
yeah,
as a theme?
I suppose that it's quite urgent at the moment. It's something that had been in the news a lot, but we didn't want to just simply tell the story, because that's in every newspaper article that you read. So we decided that what we wanted to do was to look at people's perceptions of the situation. So we carried out thousands of interviews around the country, asking people what they knew about Eastern Europe, asking them to draw a map of Europe if they could. And then, likewise, we also did lots of questionnaires asking people from Europe what their perceptions of England were, and we used all this information to kind of collate a show that is does tell the story of a girl who is trafficked here and forced into the prostitution. But it was also very important to us that it was examining our perceptions and misconceptions of the whole subject matter.
Do you think a lot of people turn their back on what's happening or don't want to know about it? And your show maybe makes people more aware?
Definitely. I think, in all honesty, that's how I felt. That's kind of why I wanted to approach the subject, because I also was aware that because it's about, you know, prostitution and sex slavery, you kind of want to put your fingers in your ears, and you don't. It's quite tacky, it's quite seedy, the whole subject, so people would rather not know. But it's so horrific, and we felt it was really important that we humanised these women and made people realise what they were going through, what they were being forced into, and not backing away from the subject.
So did you feel any way frightened of doing a production like this? Did you think you might be threatened by the people who are running this?
No. For us, it wasn't so much that. I think it was just about getting the show right and doing the justice to this subject. And we felt like that we had to get the right facts. We had to really research long and hard to make the show, because it was really important the message that it carries, and that it's right and it's well researched, and that people, and really making people think and feel for these women and what they're going through. So that made us nervous, certainly, that we were doing it justice.
And when you did your research, did you find this was happening in most of the major cities in Britain?
Yes. Oh, goodness, yeah. One of the speeches in the play, for one of the girls is talking about 7 major cities, and she's talking about how that girls like this who are trafficked can be moved on from city to city. And it's really shocking when you realise that it's literally happening around the corner from you. Coming up to Edinburgh to do the festival, and literally a week before we arrived, I read in the paper a story of a brothel that the police had raided and found 3 trafficked girls there from Eastern Europe, and that they had gone missing once the police had saved them. They went missing, and the police feared that they'd gone back to their captors because they were so scared of what would happen to their family at home.
So people know where their families are?
Yeah, there's real kind of intimidation and like blackmailing, and it's awful, like the ways, because I suppose people don't fully realise, well, why can't they just leave? Why do they stay in that situation? But often there's a lot of violence involved. Their passport and their papers are taken away from them. They have no money on them. They're locked up in these rooms. And even if they get small bits of freedom, they're too scared to do anything. They can't to tell anyone or ask for help, because they are often told that their families back at home will be hurt or will be killed if they leave, if they try to leave. So there's a lot of blackmailing and, you know, violence.
So what next after Edinburgh?
Well, we hope to tour the show. We're really interested in taking it around the country now, and like you said, like taking it particularly to all those major cities where it's so relevant. And so yeah, we hope to do that in 2009, tour the show.
Yeah. And is there trafficking in Bristol?
Certainly, yeah.
What
yeah.
about Bath?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's not the image one has of Bath, is
no,
it?
No, no. But it's so much larger and wider and deeper than you can imagine, and it's quite scary when you start to do your research into it, how something can be so underground and that you can live your life not being aware of it, and it's everywhere, and these women are going through this every day, because prostitution is a whole other ball game, and kind of the legalisation or non-legalisation of prostitution. But what is really horrific is the idea that women are being forced into prostitution. Anyone that kind of is a part of that or is aware of its goings on should do their utmost to stop it.
Yeah, so if people wanted to contact you, do you have a website?
Yes, it's it's www.thepaperbirds.com, and we've got all our email addresses on that website as well, so we can be contacted at any time.
That was Dialect's reporter Anthea Page reporting from the Edinburgh Festival.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Our next feature is from the American analyst and historian Webster Tarpley. He looks at the real cause of the current financial crisis and his ideas about the solution.
There is no perspective in the material universe, in this galaxy or any other galaxy, to prop up the black hole of $1.5 quadrillion of cancerous, fictitious, bloated derivatives. It is simply impossible. That's the heart of the crisis. This is the world derivatives crisis. It's not the world crisis of penny ante, chump change, subprime mortgages taken out by poor people who wanted to have a roof over their heads. That is a ridiculous reactionary legend being spread by people who don't want to take responsibility on the Wall Street jackals, hyenas, bloodsuckers, ticks, and others. So again, you want to get out of a depression, do the following. Comprehensive re-regulation, re-regulation, starting by what should have been done 15 years ago, outlaw derivatives. They are not assets. They have zero value, negative value. Roll back the crimes of Wendy Graham, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve, Robert Rubin, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, then head of the Treasury. Stop all foreclosures. No foreclosures for the next 5 years on homes, farms, businesses of any kind. Nix foreclosures. Want to stop foreclosures? Good. Have a uniform federal law that makes it a federal crime. Simple. Seize bankrupt institutions. My God. J.P. Morgan Chase has taken over another black hole. J.P. Morgan has now taken over the black hole of Bear Stearns, the black hole of WAMU, Washington Mutual. Now, they do have deposits, but they've also got a load of derivatives. Bank of America has now taken over two black holes, Countrywide Mortgage and a bigger black hole, Merrill Lynch. These things ought to all be seized. They've got to be seized and put through forced Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and in the process of that, the derivatives book wiped out, deleted, shredded the bonfire of the derivatives. We need to fight speculation. We need a Tobin tax, interestingly enough. There's even a guy writing now in the Washington Post who says it's time for a Tobin tax. Let me find it for you here. He does it en passant, but it's James K. Galbraith. I guess that's the son of the elder John Kenneth Galbraith. He has an op-ed in the Thursday, September 25th, Washington Post, and he just puts this in as a passing note that if you need money for various things in the current crisis, why not have a tax on the transfer of securities? Here's another problem. Why not supplement Social Security? It's a good goal. If you need a revenue source, impose a turnover tax on stocks, writes James K. Galbraith. Great idea. Got to specify. It's a Tobin tax. It's not just on stocks. It's on stocks, bonds, commodity transactions, and foreign exchange, including U.S. Treasury securities, and it's paid by the broker who sells it. And that would be a Tobin tax. 1% would immediately replenish the coffers. So some things do move. Unfortunately, Galbraith still thinks that this is a mortgage crisis rather than a derivatives crisis. It is a derivatives crisis. That is what makes it so pervasive. So outlaw derivatives, stop foreclosures, seize bankrupt institutions, put them through Chapter 11, Tobin tax, securities transfer tax, stop oil speculation, have position limits, margin requirements up to 100%, and distinguish between predatory speculators and hedgers, who are people who are actually using these commodities in their production process and need to protect themselves from fluctuations of price. Seize the Federal Reserve. Nationalize the Federal Reserve. My God, the Federal Reserve was marketed under Woodrow Wilson as an institution that would prevent any future financial panics. They have struck out numerous times. The two biggest times, they pumped in the hot money for the crash of 1929. They were trying to serve Lord Montague Norman at the Bank of England and stabilize the British pound by weakening the dollar so the comparison wouldn't be so glaring. The Federal Reserve, through deliberate monetary inflation, stoked the crisis of 1929 and then failed to do anything to stop the banking panic of 1932 to 1933, which was, of course, infinitely worse than a mere stock market crash. So that's two strikes. Now we have strike three. The Federal Reserve, under Greenspan and Bernanke, promoted derivatives, refused to regulate derivatives, and did nothing to stop the current crisis. Three strikes and you're out. Nationalize the Fed.
That was Webster Tarpley speaking, and you can find him at World Crisis Radio on gcnlive.com.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's time for Matt's Muses, a whimsical look at the world from Matthew Heap. Hello, Matt.
Hi there. The US government's debt has now got so bad that the national debt clock in New York has run out of digits to record it. They erected the clock in 1989 because they were so worried about the level of national debt, which was then $2.7 trillion. It's now $10 trillion, and given the recent bailouts, some economists are forecasting it will reach as much as $11 trillion. The news comes as an increasing number of people are considering moving abroad to countries like Saudi Arabia, where the effects of the credit crunch are less pronounced. But beware, not all is well in the playground of the super rich. Dubai has been called a man-made paradise by some, with an almost unlimited amount of oil cash funding its incredible growth. There really doesn't seem to be any limit to what they've created there, from the snow dome which allows winter sports in 40-degree desert heat, to the exotic palm-shaped man-made islands offshore. With all this money being spent, you might be surprised about what you're going to hear next. Dubai only has one sewage treatment plant, and the fact that it's completely unable to cope is causing a stink. Because of the extensive delays for queuing lorry drivers trying to get into the facility, some are giving up and dumping their load of raw sewage into the city's storm drains. Officials at the Marine and Environmental Protection Service have issued a statement reassuring tourists that all water tested is within safe limits. However, the Dubai Offshore Sailing Club, who have arranged their own independent water testing, are telling quite a different story. They say the water is now highly contaminated with bacteria and human feces floating in the sea. So far, the club has only closed one tourist beach, but say the situation can only get worse as Dubai prepares itself for the wet season. It transpires that lorry drivers are being paid for every load of raw sewage they pick up from the septic tanks, regardless of whether or not it reaches the treatment plant safely. I think we may have found what your problem is there, guys. I understand that they have some pretty harsh laws over there. Was it Dubai where the DJ Goldie got arrested at the airport for a minuscule amount of ganja found in his pocket? He was given a 4 or 5 year, I think, although it was commuted in the end. I wonder what those lorry drivers will get for dumping the raw sewage into the storm drains. Anyway, from thoughts of prisons abroad, back to thoughts of prisons at home. Some people say we are too liberal with the people doing time in this country. But I guess that depends on whether you're more into punishments or rehabilitation. In Cardiff, they pride themselves as a green city, and the prison service is no exception. Green-fingered inmates are encouraged to garden, and once again, they have come up trumps by winning one of the prestigious Cardiff in Bloom Awards. The prison service remains undecided as to how they will spend the prize, which is £1,000 and luxury bathroom goods. Which reminds me of a funny story in the news a while ago. Do you remember that guy who won the lottery whilst in prison? Whatever happened to him? Now, as we all know, the slang for prison is porridge, which brings me conveniently to my next story. Ian Bishop has finally, after 15 years of trying, become the new world porridge making champion. That means, as far as the competition is concerned, nobody else in the world can make porridge as well as he can. It's all taken very seriously. There is even a speciality porridge section, which a Dutch chef has just won with this special mixture of porridge, marzipan, homemade ice cream, and 18-year-old Glenfiddich. Porridge has been a staple of the Scottish for so long that it is steeped in myth and strange traditions. In times of old, it was extremely bad luck not to eat your porridge while standing up. You had to stir it clockwise and using the right hand to avoid invoking the devil. Furthermore, you were for it, really for it, if you referred to it by any other name than they. Ian Bishop puts his success down to local water and extreme persistence. And now on to an achievement of a different kind. Belgium Luc Costermans has broken the world speed record on an airstrip near France. He topped 192 miles per hour whilst driving a Lamborghini Calladio, which somebody lent him. 2 years ago, Mr. Costermans completed a tour of France whilst piloting a light aircraft. This is impressive enough until you learn that Mr. Costermans is in fact blind. Next, someone who won't be breaking any land speed records anytime soon, or at least we hope she won't, is Sister Cecilia Gaudet, 106-year-old American nun. The sister last voted in 1952 for President Eisenhower and hasn't been inspired to vote since. Well, until now. So which candidate has inspired her after all these years? Barack Obama, of course. What a strange life it must be being a nun, never having sex or getting married or having kids. Not that doing these things will in any way guarantee you a normal life, especially not for our next couple. And a strange couple in Cambodia, who have been married for 40 years, have just sawn their house in half after having an argument. When asked why, the husband said it was to avoid the country's convoluted divorce laws. Unless, of course, he was lying and just trying to reduce his mortgage payment in the face of the worldwide credit crunch.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time once again for another chapter of Cider with Rosie, abridged especially for Dialect Radio and read by the actor Malcolm Greaves.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. Soon after the First World War, a violent event took place in the village which drew us together in a web of silence.
Thank you, Matt.
And cut us off for a while, almost entirely.
It's now time for a song
world.
Called Crash, put together by a guy called Wilf Rodin.
But I knew those concerned and learned the whole story early. Though it was seldom discussed, and never with strangers, the facts of that night were familiar to us all, and common consent buried the whole thing deep down and raked out the tracks around it. So bloody, raw and sudden it was. It resembled an outbreak of family madness, which we took pains to conceal out of shame and pride and for the sake of those infected. The crime occurred a few days before Christmas, on a night of deep snow and homecoming, the time when the families called in their strays for an annual feast of goose. The night was as cold as Cotswold cold can be, with a wind coming straight from the Arctic. We children were in bed, blowing hard on our knees. Wives toasted their feet by the fires, while the men and youths were along at the pub, drinking hot pokered cider, cutting cards for crib, and watching their wet boots steam. But few cards were dealt or played that night. An apparition intervened. The door blew open to a gust of snow, and a tall man strode into the bar. He seemed to the drinkers both unknown and familiar. He had a sharp, tanned face, a nasal twang, and convinced of his welcome he addressed everyone by name, while they lowered their eyes and nodded. Slapping the bar, he ordered drinks all round, and then he began to talk. Everyone, save the youths, remembered this man. Now they studied the change within him. Years ago, as a pale and bony lad, he had been packed off to one of the colonies, sent by subscription and the prayers of the church, as many a poor boy before him. Usually they went and were never heard from again, and their existence was soon forgotten. Now, one of them had returned like a gilded ghost, successful and richly dressed, had come back to taunt the stay-at-homes with his boasting talk and money. He had landed that morning, he said, at Bristol, from an Auckland mutton boat. The carriage he'd hired had broken down in the snow, so he was finishing the journey on foot. He was on his way to his parents' cottage to give them a Christmas surprise. Another mile up the valley, another mile in the snow. He couldn't pass the old pub, now could he? He stood feet apart, back to the bar, displaying himself to the company. Save for his yelping voice, the pub was silent, and the drinkers watched him closely. He'd done pretty well out there, he said. Raised cattle, made a heap of money. It was easy enough if you just had the guts and weren't stuck in the bogs, like some. The old men listened, and the young men watched, with the oil lamps red in their eyes. He sent round more drinks, and the men drank them down. He talked of the world and its width and richness. He lectured the old ones for the waste of their lives, and the youths for their dumb contentment. They slogged for the squire and the tenant farmers for a miserable 12 bob a week. They lived on potatoes and by touching their caps. They hadn't a sovereign to rub between them. They saw not a thing save Mark and each other, and perhaps Stroud on a Saturday night. Did they know what he'd done? What he'd seen? What he'd made? His brown face was aglow with whiskey. He spread a sheaf of pound notes along the bar and fished a fat gold watch from his pocket. That's nothing, he said. That's only part of it. They should see his big farm in New Zealand. Horses, carriages, meat every day. And he never said sir to no one. The old men kept silent, but drank their free drinks and sniggered every so often. The youths in the shadows just gazed at the man and gazed at his spinning watch. And as he grew more drunk, they looked at each other and stole away one by one. The weather outside had suddenly hardened into a blizzard of cutting snow. The night shut down to the blinding cold and the village curled up in its sheets. When the public house closed and turned down his lamps, the New Zealander was the last to leave. He refused a lantern, said he was born here, wasn't he? And paid for his bill with gold. Then he buttoned his coat, shouted good night, and strode up the howling valley. Warm with whiskey and nearing home, he went singing up the hill. There were those in their beds who heard his last song, pitched wailing across the storm. When he reached the stone cross, the young men were waiting, a bunched group, heads down in the wind. "Well, Vincent," they said, and he stopped, and stopped singing. They hit him in turn, beat him down to his knees, beat him bloodily down in the snow. They beat and kicked him for the sake of themselves, as he lay there face down, groaning. Then they ripped off his coat, emptied his pockets, threw him over a wall and left him. He was insensible now from his wounds and the drink. The storm blew all night across him. He didn't stir again from the place where he lay, and in the morning he was found frozen to death. The police came, of course, but discovered nothing. Their inquiries were met by stares. But the tale spread quickly from mouth to mouth, was deliberately spread amongst us, was given to everyone, man and child, that we might learn each detail and hide it. The police left at last with the case unsolved, but neither we nor they forgot it. About 10 years later, an old lady lay dying, and towards the end she grew light-headed. The subject of her wandering leaked out somehow. She seemed to be haunted by a watch. "The watch," she kept mumbling. "They won't find the watch. Tell the boy to get it hid." A dark-suited stranger with a notebook in his hand appeared suddenly at her bedside. While she tossed and muttered, he sat and waited, head bent to her whispering mouth. He was patient, anonymous, and never made any fuss. He just sat by her bed all day, his notebook open, his pencil poised, the blank pages like listening ears. The old lady at last had a lucid moment and saw the stranger sitting beside her. "Who's this?" she demanded of her hovering daughter. The girl leaned over the bed. "It's all right, mother," the daughter said distinctly. "It's only a police station gentleman. He hasn't come to make any trouble. He just wants to hear about the watch." The old lady gave the stranger a sharp, clear look and uttered not another word. She just leaned back on the pillow, closed her lips and eyes, folded her hands, and died. It was the end of the weakness that had endangered her sons, and the dark-suited stranger knew it. He rose to his feet, put his notebook in his pocket, and tiptoed out of the room. This old and wandering, dying mind had been their final chance. No other leads appeared after that, and the case was never solved. But the young men who had gathered in that winter ambush continued to live among us. I saw them often about the village, simple jokers, hard-working, mild, the solid heads of families. They were not treated as outcasts, nor did they appear to live under any special strain. They belonged to the village, and the village looked after them. They are all of them dead now, anyway.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Dialect's reporter Anthea Page was at the Schumacher Conference and brought us a report, an interview with Jonathan Porritt, who chaired the conference.
Well, we've got about 500 people here. We've got about a dozen contributors, people who are making real change in people's lives through acting more sustainably, responsibly, in all sorts of different ways. And the purpose of today basically is to say that this is now the best way of thinking about solutions to the current credit crunch, to the current economic disaster. Because if we think that all we're going to do is sort out this disaster and go back to the same system that caused the disaster, that would be mad. So we need to create a different system, and basically the people here are those who are creating that different system.
I mean, do you think the credit crunch will change people's whole way of thinking? Because it's been such a worrying time for most people that they will start to rethink their lives and where we are going and not just turn their backs on the current situation.
I think realistically some people will just want to get back to where they were before the credit crunch. They will want that sense of security. They don't want to see their pensions declining. They don't want to think that their job is at risk. They want the security that came with the old system, even though, as we can see now, that security was a complete illusion. There was no security in that economic system. It was just a massive con trick. But the truth of it is a lot of people will feel more comfortable by trying to retrieve that old security. On the other hand, an awful lot of people will say, that's it. We're not going to try and build a world that looks like that again. We're going to do it differently. We're going to find a different approach to generating wealth, creating wealth, sharing wealth, a different way to looking how we might create more economic opportunities at the local level, at the regional level, not just nationally and internationally. A different approach to the whole question about taxation, about how we protect the environment. All of these things actually generate very exciting new economic ideas.
Do you think people might start to think, well, why do I need all this wealth? Could I live life simpler, in this more simple way, and share it around a bit?
I think one of the most telling points this morning was when one of our speakers reminded us that one in five people, up to 20% of the population in the UK here, suffer from one form of mental illness or another, particularly a large number of people suffering from stress or depression, whatever it might be. Now, that's one of the indirect consequences of this insane consumption-driven way of life that we've depended on for the last 30 years. So for me, an awful lot of people say, maybe I can be happier if I'm just consuming a bit less. Maybe I don't need all the pressure of being constantly in debt. Maybe I could start thinking about walking and cycling to work rather than having to rely on my car or using public transport, wherever it might be. Maybe I need to think more carefully about the food I buy and where it comes from and how I can contribute to building a better food economy locally. I just think an awful lot of people, not everybody, but an awful lot of people are going to say there are other ways of doing this.
So people could eat less and drive less and travel less.
They can certainly.
And stop this crazy cycle of go, 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 get, get, get.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is now, very apparent to people that if you look at what you can do by, for instance, just doing as many journeys as you possibly can on foot or by bike, giving up the things that you know are really bad for you, so a very large number of people know that they really shouldn't be smoking or shouldn't be drinking as much as they do. Do this. This is all fantastically good for the personal budget. Find ways of maximizing opportunities to be with other people, so increasing the leisure time that we spend with other people, which is, again, a very important part of building a more convivial society for the future. These are small-scale things, but they're really important, and they will lead to a better quality of life.
Do you think that the young people need to channel their energies into something more productive rather than just drinking and binge drinking? Do you think?
I think we're a bit hard on our young people, to be honest. I mean, it is true that a minority, and much too large a minority, but it's only a minority, do seem to derive all of their fun and games from sort of almost constant inebriation, the binge drinking that we see all too often on our television screens. But actually, the vast majority of young people today are not like that. They haven't got the money, for one thing.
Well, that's a good...
It is a good thing. And I think a lot of young people are looking at the mess that we've made of the world today, both financially and environmentally, and they're saying, well, thanks, guys. You've done us no favours at all. You've basically built this complete house of cards, which you've called a growing economy, and now that's trashed everything, and at the same time you've destroyed the natural environment. So what are you going to leave us as a legacy? Thanks a lot.
So what's your message to people out there, people of Bristol?
Well, the message really is that we are going to have to think very radically about how we improve our quality of life in a very difficult time. And that means we're going to have to think more intelligently about the nature of our economy, about how we create jobs, all of these things. And rather than just reverting to how do we get back to business as usual, we've got to take this opportunity and start thinking about what these alternatives really look like at the community level as well as nationally.
So do you have a website?
I don't. I have a blog. It's jonathanporritt.org.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anthea. Jeff Sparks is away this week, but we do have advance notice of the Rally Against Climate Change conference coming up in December.
My name is Kathleen. I'm with the Campaign Against Climate Change. This is a really important campaign, and we're bringing it all together Saturday, December 6th at Grosvenor Square in London. That's the same time when the United Nations is going to get together and have a gab fest about what we should do about climate change. And we want to show that we are upset. We want citizens to get out there and show that we want more than a gab fest. We want action. We want massive investment in renewable energy. We want energy efficiency. We want low carbon transport. And we want thousands of new green jobs. George Monbiot will be one of the speakers, and we want you to be one of the listeners and one of the marchers. So if you can come and join us at Grosvenor Square at noon, December 6th, and if you're interested in more information, go to www.campaigncc.org. That's the Campaign Against Climate Change. Thanks.
Steve Treble was here in the studio last week, and it was a wonderful, brilliant interview, so feel free to listen to that. He's opened a new shop at 137 Princess Victoria Street in Clifton, or you can always visit treblerock.co.uk. I'm pretty sure it's a .co.uk. So if you want to see Bristol's music scene survive, then don't buy off the internet. Buy from your local shops and keep them in business. You'll get a lot better advice and customer service as well. You never know really what you're getting if you buy on the internet. This is the end of this week's Dialect Radio show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based in the city centre. Thank you very much to today's studio guest, Josie Hill, from the 125 organisation. Reminder of their website address, which is www.one5.org.uk. That is a bit confusing. I'll just read that again. Right, www.one5.org.uk. The feature by Webster Tarplew was brought to us by our very own Tony Gosling, and Matt Heap read us his muse for the week. Thank you to Malcolm Gree for reading another instalment of Cider with Rosie, to be continued next week, and other features were by Anthea Page. Mark Condon was studio engineer, and this week's show was produced by Anthea Page. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Next week in our studio, the guest will be film director Elliot Bristow. So it's goodbye from all of us here at Dialect Radio, and John Peters Coleman, the presenter of this week's show. Until next week, goodbye. Take care of yourselves.